We'll get started. We don't have a quorum yet. I think a few of our members are over at a signing with the governor right now. And Representative Albrecht, if you want to come down and explain your bill, and hopefully we get a quorum so we can take a vote on it. And I see he got the memo about freshmen providing treats, and I thank you for that. And so, Representative Albrecht, welcome to the committee, and please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 758 would add a representative from the adult basic education programs as a non-voting member to the Governor's Workforce Development Council. Legislature already did this for public libraries. Adult basic education provides literacy and basic skills education for low-skilled adults to help them become self-sufficient and to participate effectively as workers, family members, and citizens. Primary audience includes new Americans, native-born Americans, and those who've dropped out of school. Nearly all are low income. Last year, ABE programs across the state provided services to over 74,000 adults. Of Minnesota's 3.3 million working-age adults, 60% have not completed any college. Of these, 251,000 have not completed high school. 61,000 speak little or no English. Workforce Development Council is charged with a variety of responsibilities that include reviewing federal, state, education, post-secondary job skills training programs, and recommending the governor and legislature on the establishment of an integrated, seamless system providing education, work skill services to learners and workers of all ages. Representatives from all of the education programs now include the university, K-12, and MNSCU, but the council does not include a slot for ABE. Federal law dictates the composition of the council, and that's why I'm proposing to include an ABE representative as a non-voting member of the council. This would allow them to be at the table and include the broader discussion of education and workforce development. It's important that we have all of the education programs at the table to make sure that services are coordinated for a wide variety of learners throughout the state. I have Eric Nesheim with me today, who is here representing the Literacy Action Network, statewide organization of ABE providers. He was a member of the council and is able to describe the need for ABE input into the council activities. Thank you, Chair and members.
And what, before you start, I'll officially call the meeting to order, and I'll move House File 758 to be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Jobs, Economic Development, Policy, and Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Nesheim. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Literacy Council, and today I represent the Literacy Action Network, which is a professional organization for adult basic education programs across the state. As a field, adult basic education currently serves 74,000 Minnesotans in about 500 sites around the state through services such as GED, adult diploma, basic skills, English as a second language, family literacy, citizenship, transitions to work, and post-secondary education training. ABE is increasingly providing a wide range of job skills and occupational prep programming, thus becoming an important player in workforce development. I'm here to offer my testimony in support of House File 758, adding a non-voting ABE representative to the Governor's Workforce Development Council. I'm sure, as many of you are aware, that GWDC's mission is to analyze and recommend workforce development policies to the governor and the legislature towards talent development, resource alignment, and system effectiveness to ensure a globally competitive workforce for Minnesota. The governor's workforce development has a variety of duties. The representative mentioned a few. It's also to advise the governor on coordinating services and funds from the Workforce Investment Act and the Carl Perkins Vocational Applied Technology Education Act. Over the past few years, I had the pleasure of serving on the GWC as a community representative. My three-year term recently ended, but during my time on the council, I came to realize that a large portion of the discussion involved adult basic education and collaboration with adult basic education. I was able to answer questions and offer input and insight because I'm an ABE practitioner, and I was able to bring back valuable information to enhance our collaboration and cooperation with workforce programs and MNSCU. Unfortunately, when my term ended, so did ABE's connection to the council. I believe that the Governor's Workforce Development Council members and staff deeply valued having an ABE voice on the council, though unofficial. Additionally, it should be noted that the Minnesota Fast Track, which is an effort to help educationally underprepared adults achieve success in well-paying careers, has occupied a great deal of the GWDC's time and resources over the past few years. This project is a collaborative effort between MNSCU, DEED, and Adult Basic Education. I believe that Fast Track will continue to play a large role in the future. However, one of the key players will go unrepresented on the council if we don't make this change. Federal law dictates that composition of the council, which is why we're proposing to include an ABE representative as a non-voting member. This would allow us to be at the table and included in the broader discussion of education and workforce development, a discussion in which we play a large role. Again, we really appreciate the help from the representative and from this group, and thank you so much for your commitment to a greater Minnesota.
Questions of the testifier or the author? Anybody in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 758 pass and be re-referred to the Jobs, Economic Development, Policy, and Finance Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bills, the motion's passed, and the motion's approved. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Member. Representative Bly. Hopefully this will go as easy. I'll move that House File 338 be before us. And I believe it has to go to rules.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that's correct. This is a bill that falls under the eminent domain statutes and has to do with making some adjustments to the buy the farm part of that. And just to kind of quickly move through it, I'd like to have my testifier explain that. He's been dealing with these issues quite a bit. And so if you'd introduce yourself, Rod.
Thank you. Chair Nelson, members, my name is Rod Crass. I practice law in the condemnation area and have been representing a number of people, primarily farm folks, who are impacted by the CapEx 2020 345 kilovolt transmission line that's going across Minnesota in several places in our state from the Dakotas through on into Wisconsin and places east. There was a law passed in 1977 called Buy the Farm, and it resulted from a lot of unrest and unhappiness with the last major transmission line of high voltage nature that went through the state, and there was a lot of civil disobedience and unrest and unhappiness by particularly farm folks who did not want themselves and particularly their stock living and working under these power lines. And the legislature responded by saying, if a major power line above 200 kV, and this is 345,000 volts, goes across your property, instead of simply being responsible or reactive to a request by the utility for an easement to allow the line to go across your property, you can elect to have the utility purchase your entire property. There are, I won't go through them, but a list of criteria you have to meet in order to avail yourself of this right. But assuming you do, you have that option. You can ask them to buy the farm. Issues have come up in this most recent transmission line because since 77 there hasn't been much in the way of major above 200 kilovolt lines, and consequently the statute is starting to get litigated now. And the folks at CapEx, who are a consortium of 11 utilities led by NSP, taken the position that folks who make a determination that they want the utility to buy the farm are not entitled to the same benefits and rights they would have if, for instance, the state of Minnesota came along or the county came along and bought their farm for a highway interchange, as an example. Specifically, what has been in front of some courts is the issue of whether two of the rights, relocation benefits and what is called minimum compensation, which was a new benefit the legislature put in the major overhaul of the condemnation statute back in 2006, those two, they contend, are not available to folks who exercise the buy the farm right, because they claim it's a voluntary leaving, that they're not required to leave, they're doing so voluntarily. And what this bill does is to make certain and clear that all of the rights, including those two that are in Chapter 117 that are available to people when their property is taken, are also available when buy the farm elections are made. That's the primary purpose of this bill, to make sure these folks have this right. And I would tell you why it's so important. For many of these people, if you can envision, for instance, a dairy farm or something of that nature, a stock farm, a hog farm, the issue of compensating people for having to move doesn't end with the value of their property being paid to them. And that's what CapEx has said. That's the position they've taken. What you get is the value of your property, fair market value of your property. But that doesn't get them to a new place. And without, for instance, the rights of relocation benefits, a lot of people who would like to exercise the right the legislature gave them under Buy the Farm are unable to do so, because the additional costs over and above the land are prohibitive. It is, when you think about moving a dairy operation or an organic farm, and there are folks here from both who would like, I know, to tell their story to you. If you think about moving them and the cost of moving them, many of them will be unable to exercise this right you've given them, because they're going to have to assume too many of the cost burdens. We've heard an argument before from CapEx that, well, gee, if we make the utilities pay all the costs involved in these condemnations, they'll have to pass that on to the utility users. Yes, they will. And the point is, that's exactly what should happen. If the state condemned that farm for the interchange I mentioned earlier, the taxpayers in the entire state of Minnesota would pay those things like minimum comp and relocation benefits, because they're real costs. They're real out-of-pocket costs, and the question should be, who should pay them? The poor folks who happen to be in the way of the line, or everyone who's going to benefit from that line? There's no question this utility line is going to help create a better service for everybody who utilizes it. Literally millions of Minnesotans, I'm certain, and people from other states too. The issue is not whether it's a good thing, it's whether the people, and particularly farmers who happen to be in the way, should pay a disproportionate share. And our suggestion is they should not. We've also put in a couple of what we really think are kind of housekeeping issues on this bill, including taking away the restriction on the ability of the utilities to pay a lower amount for appraisals. If the state takes your farm, you get $5,000. The utilities have this special deal. They only have to pay $3,000. And the truth is, for a condemnation appraisal that will stand up under cross-examination, neither number takes care of that cost. But there's no reason the utilities should pay less than the state, and we've addressed that. We've addressed a couple of other issues, just timing issues. The statute says that the property owner only has 60 days after the condemnation petition is filed to make his election, but there is no restriction on how long the utility has to respond to that. They could wait 6 months. This particular utility is not doing that. They're answering within a very reasonable time, but who knows what's going to happen next. And so we're suggesting if folks have 60 days to elect, the utility should have 60 days to say we accept your election, or for the following reasons we reject it, so that we can get moving on that. And then we've asked if that happens, if there's a rejection, then there ought to be a reasonable time limit. We've suggested 90 days to get this in front of a court and make that decision, so these people have some finality and know what's going to happen. So there's a few provisions like that, and unfortunately I saw the title of the bill as it was listed as being related to this issue of compensation for the appraisal, and that's a very small tail on a large animal here. The main purpose of this bill is to avail by the farm electors to the same rights anybody else would have if their entire property was condemned.
Representative Bly.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have a couple of amendments that would get the bill in the shape that I like, if someone could move those amendments.
We've got an A4, an A3, and an A5.
I think I don't have the number of bills or the number of amendments that you have with you. Let's do the, is it
A4 and A5?
Must be the A4 first. That's the shortest one, right?
A4, yep. I'm a little slow on the uptake.
Okay, sorry.
And the A3 was active.
Yeah, it's the A4, it's this one. Okay. And when we did first an informational hearing in the Energy Committee, and the municipal utilities came forward and had some concerns about Section 1, and so we decided just to satisfy them to delete that. And when we had a hearing in Energy, we moved that amendment, and unfortunately, for some unknown reason, a different amendment got printed onto the bill, so we still need to remove that from the language. So that's why we're doing this.
So I'll move the A4 amendment. Any questions? If not, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted.
I think the A3 and the A5 are identical. They're not? Okay. The A5 is the one that I wanted to... I want to ignore the A3 and do the A5. And I have an oral amendment. I'm not sure how this happened, but there's something left off. And the oral amendment would be on line 1.6 to delete the word commerce and insert the word agriculture.
Ms. Dyson, do you have that?
Yes.
So I'll move the A5 amendment with the modification on line 1.6 to change the Department of Commerce to the Department of Agriculture. And this is to Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question of why we're moving to the Department of Ag, and I think I know what the answer is by the title of this, by the farm.
Right.
But is it not also true that Commerce has jurisdiction with the Public Utilities Commission and stuff? And I'm just wondering, don't they both, if you will, have a vested interest in this, or moving it from one vested party to another vested party that has jurisdiction?
Representative Bly.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. Representative O'Driscoll, that may be the case. I guess I had to choose one or the other. My thinking was that the Ag Department might have more understanding of the land values and the issues that farmers would face. That's why I made the choice to move it there. So that's my explanation.
Representative O'Driscoll. Any more questions on the amendment? If not,
Representative Pepin, did you have a question on the amendment? Or
no, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, what is the path of the bill? Where did you send it to?
Rules is where it's going to end up go to.
Because it's not going to meet deadline?
Yes.
Okay. Could I ask Representative Bly where it would need to go after rules? It would still have to go to the committee process after rules, I believe.
Right. I believe it has to go to civil law.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I believe it has to go to civil law. And then I would plan to have it go to Ag Finance.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, if it's a ombudsman, there's going to be a fiscal note potentially, so I just wanted to make sure that it was going to finance.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. Again, on the amendment, we've moved the A5 amendment with the modification. All in favor of the A5 amendment to put it in the form the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. So, Representative Bly, you have testifiers?
I do, and I wanted to respect the committee and make sure that was okay with you if we had people speak and how much time you want to allot for the bill.
Why don't you, if they can do it in 10-15 minutes, I know there's people that probably want to speak against it. Representative Hansen? Sure, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bly, I understand what you're trying to do here. My question is, when I'm reading who this applies to with contiguous land, let's say there's a small business that's in the way of the power line, and it's with the small business owner who owns, maybe it's only an acre, but they have a small business that's in the path, would they have the same rights under this bill as a farmer?
Representative Bly.
I'm going to refer to my expert testifier here because I'm not 100% sure. That's not it.
Mr. Kraft.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Nelson. The answer to your question is this bill does not address that issue. That the provisions of the original law as passed in 77 state what qualifies for buy the farm. And generally it is agricultural, homestead or non-homestead, and residential, and some residential recreational.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's what I interpreted it to be. 1977 was a long time ago. And I think it's important to recognize that, and my brother farms, I grew up on a farm, I own farmland, but the farms are businesses. And if you're treating businesses one way, that they have certain protections, but you have another business that's going to be impacted the same way, why can't they have the same protection? And that exclusivity of protection for one small business or large business versus another, I think, is something, just because it's been that way, we may want to take a look at this as this bill moves on, because I could see a small business that's in the way that has the exact same concerns. They put their life into something, and it may impact their business. I don't have any specific example, but just because things have been one way doesn't necessarily need to be the same way.
Representative Bly.
I agree with you, Representative Hansen, and I'd be happy to talk with you about a way to accomplish that if we could. I don't know if we could do it in this bill. My bringing this bill forward is because of an urgency that I knew of with some farmers who faced this and really needed to have the protection that was there. I don't deny that there are others who probably have the need for the same equal protection.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask some questions of the testifier, which I think will help with the pro and the con discussion as we come up, just kind of backgrounding a little bit, eminent domain here in the state of Minnesota. Utilities have by the creation of those utilities, some limited right of eminent domain. And I think what you're looking to try to do is to even the playing field, if I could use that term, for the consumer when it comes to that type of situation, versus, as you said, if it was a public taking or a political subdivision of the state of Minnesota taking on that. The question that I have for you is, the reason for these changes, are you finding that there's not an adequate amount of compensation for damages under eminent domain law for individuals? You said an individual who might have to relocate their business. Some of those businesses might have to cease operation as a result of the remainderment that's available or left after the eminent domain, lost wages, lost future revenues. I'm just looking for a definition of what it is that you're thinking these damages might go, because there are, I won't say the sky's the limit, but there's an awful lot of things under the word damages or compensation that can be. I'm just wondering if you could kind of narrow that down, or Representative Bly, if you've got some experience there as well.
Representative Bly.
I would just say, if you'd like, the testifiers might speak to some of that, and then I could have my expert, you know, fill that out a bit more. Do you want to hear what they have to say, just to expedite?
Mr. Chair, I'm fine. I just think that needs to be an extremely important part of the discussion as to the scope of what kind of damages that we're looking for, so that people are properly compensated, or we don't get into inverse condemnation kinds of issues and questions. And I think the members of the committee need to have some background on that in order to make this very important decision today.
Let me respond. Okay, go ahead. Mr. Krause?
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Driscoll. You are correct. It is an effort to make certain that the condemnor, whoever that is, doesn't affect the damages, whatever are allowed by law, that someone receives, because that's what the law is doing right now. If the condemnor is the county, you have one set of damages. If it's a utility, you have fewer sets of damages. I mentioned the two that are the main, the issue of relocation and the issue of minimum compensation. And minimum compensation is the concept that the legislature put in 06 that says sometimes obtaining an alternate site or an alternate farm or whatever it is may cost more than the actual market value of the farm that is taken from you. And to put someone in the same position, the legislature has said we're going to establish this concept of minimum compensation and say it's not just the amount that your property is worth on the open market if you can't replace it for that, because you've got to go someplace, and if the only thing that is available to you costs more, then that's going to have to be part of the cost, because otherwise you can't move. Or otherwise, if you don't get, for many of these folks, you don't get those relocation benefits, you can't move. So you could, if the state condemned your farm, you can't if a utility does. And that's the problem.
Representative Driscoll.
I'll defer my questions till later, but we do need to continue this line of questioning, I think, because there are some things that folks just really need to understand as it relates to this, and I know that the testifiers will have some background as well for us on how they've been affected by this.
Representative Winkler and Representative Pepin, do you want to wait till the testifiers are done to ask your questions, or do you want to ask them now?
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I kind of have a baseline question that I'd like to ask, and maybe Mr. Krause can address them, perhaps the testifiers. Just want to make sure I have the basic understanding here correct. Essentially, utilities have a lesser obligation to property owners than a government unit does in condemnation of land for whatever reason. Is that correct? And can you provide a public policy explanation for why that would be the case?
Mr. Krause.
Chair Nelson and Representative Winkler and members, you are absolutely correct. That's the other side of the coin I was talking to Representative Driscoll about. There is less obligation on the part of utilities than there would be on the part of a government. I can think of no public policy reason why that should be true. As I mentioned before, the argument was, all the ratepayers will have to pay all of the costs of this condemnation if this amendment is passed, and our response is yes, they should.
And Mr. Chair, that's a standing question to anybody who wants to testify on this bill for me.
Representative Pepin, do you want to ask your question now or do you want to wait until after the testimony?
Mr. Chair, my question just had to do with the question that Representative Hansen asked about small business or about businesses having the same opportunity or not opportunity, and he made his interpretation, and I wanted to check with Ms. Dyson. Do you remember when he was asking about whether it would apply to businesses as well? And they both had said that they didn't think it applied to businesses according to the statute, and I just wanted to verify if that was your understanding as well.
Ms. Dyson.
Oh, but you weren't listening when they were having that conversation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, when you say this apply, I'm not clear what...
By the farm, if it applies to whether or not the by the farm applies to small businesses and whether or not this language making this the change would apply to other businesses besides farms. Obviously, farm is a business too, but other businesses.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, in 2006, the changes to the eminent domain law at that time applied to other takings, so businesses and entities under the changes under the general eminent domain law were affected. The by the farm statute, I'm not as familiar with, but that it would I don't know how it applies in this context, but in 2006, in a general sense, businesses and let me restart. In 2006, the law changes were primarily to deal with use of eminent domain for economic development and to say you can't do that for economic development alone. Yes. And so there were a number of compensation provisions put into law at that time that applied in that context but that do not apply to the public service corporations or didn't until 2010. But so I'm not answering your question.
Mr. Kress.
Wait.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think I can answer your question because the statute's pretty clear and it identifies private real property that is agriculture or non-agricultural homestead, non-homestead agricultural land, rental residential property, and both commercial and non-commercial seasonal residential recreational property as those terms are defined by statute. So those are the limited categories.
Thank you. It's helpful.
Representative Pepin. Representative Blythe, if you want to get testifiers down, and we'll go to about quarter two, and then I believe there's opposition, so we'll get them down here also. You want to identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Hi, my name is Julie Schwartz. My husband and I, Dale, he's over there. We run a 100-cow dairy and a 575-acre farm. This line, we have a long driveway, one-third mile long, and a little longer than that, actually. This line comes down along our driveway, along the property line. Because these poles have 15-foot arms, that means every time we go up and down our driveway, we will be directly under these lines. We also mix feed there, underneath this line, alongside of it. So this isn't just a safe distance. They talk about being a safe distance away. We don't have a safe distance. There's varying degrees of what they call safe distance, but we don't have that. Because we were in hopes that we could have any chance of staying there. We went out to Wisconsin and talked to some dairy farmers out there that actually have cows about the same distance as us, but they have field in between, where I said we have nothing in between. They went 8 to 10 years ago. CapEx had a line out there, and they went from one of the top herds in their state, 27,000 pound rolling herd average. I don't know if you understand what that means, but they dropped to 16. They had cows die, calves die, cows aborted. It took 6 to 10 breedings to keep cows pregnant. That's a tremendous cost. You hope to get cows bred 1 to 3 or less. So it had a huge effect on their herd. A year ago we were out there and they got abscess-like marks, burn-like marks on their legs because of the voltage coming in. The husband after whenever it gets to a certain point, his whole body would break out in a rash. And the wife had some reaction, but not as severe. And I didn't ask if they had cancers or anything like that. I mean, there's a whole host of things you can find out there. They can't deny a link to childhood leukemia anymore. So we went out to Wisconsin hoping that we could find something that would help us. We found out recently that when our land was condemned for our case, it was May 9th, and the appraisal goes back to the day the condemnation was done. CapEx at that time said our land's worth $7,000 an acre. We have land going in our area close to us between $10,000 and $12,000 an acre. That would mean to replace our land base without including any buildings, that would mean that we would have to borrow additional $500,000 to $1 million just to replace our same land base. And this does nothing to give us compensation for our buildings. There's no way we can find a dairy with the type of buildings we have. We'll be married next month 30 years, and it took 30 years for us to build this farm up. Both our kids are a part of it. It'd be a century farm in about 8 years. And to rebuild what we have, 15 years ago, we put up a freestall and put a flat parlor. Most of the buildings on this farm are now new since we've been married. So to give us a few hundred thousand to replace that, there's no way we can do it. Steel's gone up. Cement's gone up. Wood's gone up. Everything that we would need to replace it. That's why this is so important and so urgent that this bill gets through, because if this doesn't happen, there's no way we can rebuild somewhere else, and our cows will have to go. We will lose our income from our cows and probably from our land. This is our best quality land. It's our highest yielding land. And to go to a different place, and we've been trying for almost 2 years to find a different farm to move. As you know, eggs getting smaller, there's less of us dairy farms. There's already dairy farmers that have sold their cows because of this transmission line coming through and the effects it would have on their herd. My husband, unfortunately, we found out a couple weeks ago, he's on the Stryker recall hip replacement. He had a hip done in June. It'll be through 3 years, and he's got to have that done. Our doctor asked how far away is your house, and our house, we have buildings between the line and our house, but our house is a little over 400 feet away. He said that's too close. He did not hesitate. He said it's too close. In CapEx's own paperwork, it says it can affect pacemakers or implantable defibrillators, artificial limbs, screws, and pins, and that's just a small part of what this line can do. We are under it. We can't get away from it, so we're just asking that this law gets clarified. In the Senate hearing, Gene Merriam at the Energy Committee testified. He couldn't be there through a paper. You have that?
Okay. Yes, it was passed
so
on.
So then you know that he was there when this this bill got passed, and that he agrees that this is what the bill was supposed to do. So we're just asking for clarification that we can have the rights. It's urgent that this gets done, because it's miles and miles of transmission line dissecting our whole state. It's just not the few of us that are here, it's people throughout our whole state. And I get phone calls and people that I talk to almost on a daily basis what they're going through and what their fears are, and they don't know what to do either. And until we find out what we can get compensated, we can't even go through really with Buy the Farm, because we don't have money, or we don't know if we will be able to move on to build. So I'm just asking for your support to clarify this law so that we can move on. There's people over 2 years that have been dealing with this, and they, where do we, you know, how can you continue your life if you don't know, you have no deadline, you have no information, you don't know what you're going to do. So thank you for listening. I know there's other ones here that have their story too.
Thank you, Ms. Schwartz.
Any questions?
I don't see any. The other gentleman here?
Yes, sir.
Please thank give
you,
your
Mr.
name for the
Chairman,
tape.
The committee members. My name is Dave Menar. My wife Lawrence is in the audience, and our children operate Cedar Summit Farm at rural New Prague in the southern end of Scott County. We have a unique situation. We're an organic dairy farm, and we have a creamery on our farm that we built 12 years ago. And we direct market our milk all over the Twin Cities and the upper Midwest. We foresaw this power line coming, and we were really worried about this. And You know, I have a friend just lived just north of us, about 10 miles, that moved. He was under a 345 kilovolt line, and he looked for 5 years for a farm to move to so he could get it out from under those power lines, because it affected his cattle, it affected their whole family's health, and he finally moved to Wisconsin. You know, this is the kind of thing that really scares us. It's got us up in the air. Our friends are asking me, what are you going to do? You know, I don't know what it's going to... I won't know until they throw the switch how it's going to affect us, how it's going to affect our cattle. But we really need this legislation, because we need to be able to move out of there if we have to. And for us to find an organic dairy farm that's got... We're going to need 400 acres or so to maintain our 120-cow dairy. And to find that kind of an organic farm in contiguous or with all the acres close together is going to be nearly impossible for us. In being certified organic and buying just conventional land, we have a 3-year wait because USDA National Organic Program says the land has to be farmed organically for 3 years before you can feed any of the feed to your livestock that are certified organic. So for us, it's going to be a long wait, and it could virtually put us out of business. It took us 12 years to establish a customer base around the Twin Cities and upper Midwest for our products. And so it looks like we're going to end up starting all over again unless we can find an organic dairy farm somewhere. So we need this additional compensation and to cover the cost of moving to another farm.
Thank you, Mr. Menard.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Menard.
Thank you.
Other testifiers. Representative Bly, do you have one more testifier? That
can she get one more comment?
Quickly.
Yep, quickly. We were told that this line was going to be energized in 2015, and now we know it's going to be energized, or their prediction is July of this year. So that to move a dairy or any farm is a huge undertaking, and there's just not dairies out there to move to.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Chair, Representatives. My name is Bradley Lindberg. My wife, Linda, and I own and operate a 63-acre farm in Clearwater, where we've lived for 23 years. Our farm has been crossed by CapEx 2020 high-voltage power line. We did not sign the easement agreement with CapEx, so 7.5 acres of our property along I-94 has been condemned and taken by eminent domain to be used as CapEx 2020 wished. The easement that CapEx insisted on for their project has destroyed a portion of our property and gives CapEx 2020 the right to drive through our farmyard wherever they choose. They cut our almost mile-long row of trees that we planted nearly 20 years ago and nurtured into a beautiful border along the freeway, and erected 4 unsightly 150-foot high-voltage power line towers on our property. Our fences have been moved, and we have been informed that we cannot irrigate, build, or replant the trees in the easement area. We cannot raise crops in this area because they left the tree stumps there and refused to remove them. Our personal use of our land has been limited by CapEx's easement conditions, and we must tolerate trucks and equipment driving through our yard. We feel that this is a serious invasion of our privacy and a safety concern for our grandchildren and animals. Also, we are not convinced that there is not a health risk to people that live close to such high voltage power lines. Because of these concerns, although we had no prior intention of moving from our farm, we had hoped to live for the rest of our lives, we elected to exercise our statutory right to have the power company purchase our entire farm. We just could not bear the intrusion through our farmyard and the destruction of our property that CapEx demanded with their easement conditions. Since the CapEx condemnation of our property, we have allowed them to access our farm and homestead according to their condemnation requirements, but they have delayed and strung us along. CapEx representatives told us that we would be reimbursed for our crop damage caused by their equipment, but first they wanted us to sign an agreement stating that we would not take legal action. We did not sign that agreement. and we have not been compensated for the lost crop revenue. They have accused us of being unreasonable, questioned our intentions, required us to have inspections, driven up our attorney's costs, and have even doubted the commercial viability and value of our property. It took over 2 years before a commissioner's hearing was scheduled to hear our testimony related to the large discrepancy between the value of the value given to our property by CapEx and the CapEx appraiser and the appraiser we hired. During all that time, CapEx did not commit to buying our farm. It cost us over $8,000 for the appraiser and his testimony. This is just one portion of the financial expenses to us so far. We are still waiting for the commissioner's award. CapEx has moved their project through our property, and the high voltage lines are up and running while our lives have been in limbo for more than 2.5 years. The delays and tactics by CapEx in dealing with landowners is disrespectful and indicates a high disregard for the people who have been deeply affected by the erection of their high voltage power line. This has caused landowners to hire attorneys to safeguard their rights, adding to the financial burden. Because of our experience, we strongly support the proposed legislation that would give us some certainty to the landowners affected by large utility projects and to clarify what we believe the Buy the Farm law originally intended, to give landowners of property in the paths of high voltage power lines and the option to have their entire property purchased at fair price and in a timely manner, so that the owner can relocate if they choose not to live near a high voltage power line. We ask that you make it clear that when people like us face this type of involuntary condemnation, we are eligible for relocation and condemnation benefits according to Minnesota laws and eminent domain. Thank you.
Thank you. Opponents. And we'll go to about five after, and then we'll questions. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape. Yeah, grab one of the chairs there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Lesher with CapEx 2020. I am the routes and land rights lead for the CapEx 2020 Brookings to Hampton project. And I really appreciate the time to come and address you today regarding House File 338. Just a little bit of background about the CapEx projects. As Mr. Kratz mentioned, they're a joint initiative of 11 utilities that make up CapEx. And the main goals of the CapEx projects are to expand and update the transmission grid in Minnesota and the surrounding states, which I should mention has not been done since about the 70s when high voltage transmission line was last expanded in the state. It provides safe and reliable electricity, which we're all very dependent on in these times. And also provides transmission capacity, especially for renewables, which the Brookings Project and others are keying into is bringing a lot of the wind energy from the Buffalo Ridge and surrounding areas to the market. The CapEx projects, there are five different projects, about 800 miles of transmission, 345 kV and a 230 kV project. They come at a cost of $2.2 billion. and they're in varying stages of permitting and construction right now. So lots of infrastructure is part of the CapEx projects. So listening to some of the discussions, I think it's important to understand a little bit about when we get a permit, the two permits from the Public Utilities Commission, the state route permits and the certificate of need permits, how we then go and work with property owners during the acquisition process itself. For the projects and the routing, when the projects were looked at and the routes were decided, it's important to remember that back in the 70s, When you had point A to point B, a lot of times it was just a straight line for transmission lines. They went cross-country. They didn't take a lot of time to look at some of the infrastructure that was existing. A lot of them went right through the middle of agricultural fields. And in today's new routing world, there's a lot of time and effort been put into the routing of the transmission lines. So for the most part, the transmission lines are put on the edges of properties, following property boundaries, section lines, so that the transmission lines are not going through the middle of fields and are really the impacts we're trying to keep as small as possible when it comes to these transmission lines. And that goes for all of the projects that we have. They all have an extensive route permit process that has been looked at. So as we've been moving forward, when we need an easement for one of these transmission lines, we go and talk to the property owner, try and get questions and concerns answered, and then present to them what the easement is. So generally, like I mentioned, it's on the outside of a piece of property on the edge that we're dealing with. On these particular projects, we're talking about a 75-foot easement, 75 from the center, so 150 feet total. Depending on where that easement is, it could be as much as 150 feet or as little as about 75 to 80 feet. So we work with the property owners. We present the easement. We also present an offer based on fair market value at that particular moment in time. We can't foresee what the market will do, but we present that offer. And then, you know, as part of the process, the statutes in Minnesota, property owners have a couple of options that are unique to us as a permitting and an energy facility. They have obviously the rights of eminent domain, which are as a electric utility, we have the rights of eminent domain. They also have the ability to use that to try and determine what the fair market value is of that easement, so they can go through the eminent domain process, and ultimately commissioners can determine what the value of that easement is if they feel that our offer is not substantial enough. So that is something that is open to property owners for all of these projects. They have the right to eminent domain. But I think what's important here is the rights of the property owner for by the farm, which I should mention is very unique in the country. We are the only state in the country that has a by the farm act, and it was, like Mr. Kras said, it was put in the statutes in 77, primarily because of a transmission line that that did go cross country and was very controversial. So it was put on the books, and since that time, it's been used very seldom. Only a couple of times since that time. And now CapEx has come along, and we're sort of dusting off the by the farm statute and moving forward with it. But my point is that it's very unique to the states, and it's very unique to the electrical infrastructure, to utilities, as it pertains to the acquisition of properties. So if I use an example of putting an easement on somebody's property, maybe a couple of acres of easement on the edge of their property, the property owner has the ability to expand the taking, not just for those couple of acres of easement, but can expand the taking to the whole property, so by the farm. And we have been working with that, and as the bill points out, there are some concerns with the process of by the farm that need to be looked at, such as the timing of our response to an election of by the farm, and also, as Mr. Kras mentioned, some concerns about appraisals. I'll speak specifically on those two issues as far as the timing and the appraisal issue. We don't have a problem with that. So it's something that we think is beneficial. It's something that we continue to work with Mr. Kras on when it comes to the timing and the and being more descriptive about by the farm. It's a law that's on the books, but it needs some more definition, and we all agree that that would be helpful not only to Mr. Kras and his clients, but also to us to understand the step-by-step process. And we've been working with Mr. Kras and others to try and define that as we've been moving along here. So we will continue to do that. But I think I think the part that really is concerning to us is the minimum comp and relocation. I'll say it's called minimum comp, but it's really additional compensation as opposed to the minimum compensation. It's think of it as additional compensation. That part concerns us, and the reason it does is because we feel that the election to expand the taking from just the easement to expand it into the entire property is a voluntary election. We are not displacing people from their homes. If we put the transmission line over the tops of people's homes, which as I go back to the routing process, we just do not do in today's routing of the transmission lines. But if we did, and the lines went right over the top of the house, and for maintenance reasons, we needed to make sure that we had access to that easement, so the house would have to go. Generally, houses are not permitted. Well, they are not permitted in the easement area. Then that house would need to disappear. And in those cases, we would understand that minimum compensation and relocation would be something that would be necessary. But in 99% of the cases that we are dealing with easements that are on the edge of people's properties. We are not forcing people to leave their homes, and property owners are electing by the farm. And we have no problem with paying fair market value for that property, but when it comes to relocation and minimum compensation, the statute clearly calls for that property owner that minimum compensation and relocation applies only when the property owner must relocate. And we would say that the property owner does not need to relocate in that case. They have every right to elect by the farm and move on, but the additional compensation that would be required, which can be significant in a lot of cases, would not apply to those takings. And if I look at that example of a couple of acres of easement and I apply it to a road project, let's say for MnDOT, if MnDOT wanted to expand their road and expand it by a couple of acres, so expand the road out, there would not be a reason for MnDOT to take the farm, to buy the farm, to take the entire property. They would pay the property owner for that election, for that easement, or the fee taking for the roadway expansion. But the election, the property owner would not have the ability to expand that election to the entire property, and thus there would not be an option for minimum compensation and relocation. Using Mr. Crass's example of an interchange, let's say, I would agree that if that interchange, and I am certainly not a road planner, but if that interchange took a significant percentage of the property that they were dealing with, and potentially that roadway went where the house is or the building is, it would force that person to have to relocate and leave their property. And in that case, MnDOT would be on the hook for minimum compensation and relocation, but not for an easement that is on the edge of a property that does not take the home or have to displace the person. And so I think that there's a big distinction there, and something where if we're talking about leveling the playing field and being fair, there is some significant difference there on what generally MnDOT does on their cases versus what we're doing with a small easement taking on the edge of somebody's property. So I just wanted to make sure that came across, that there is a distinction there. So we have argued that minimum comp and relocation does not apply in the cases that we are dealing with, and we took it to the Minnesota to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And I believe that was earlier in 2012, right, Pat? And in that case, the Minnesota Court of Appeals did agree. It was not unanimous, but they did agree with us that in the cases of by the farm, it's a voluntary action, and so minimum compensation and relocation does not apply. That has since gone on to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and it's currently in front of them right now. Oral arguments are scheduled for April 3rd, and we believe that a full rendering of the case should come through sometime mid to end of summer. So that is currently in process and before the Supreme Court for a decision, and we are interested, obviously, to know what that will do and what their decision will be. But that, I believe, should give guidance. The Supreme Court should give guidance to what we need to do as far as the legislation when it comes to buy the farm, the buy the farm laws. And so we as a utility would ask that instead of taking this bill forward at this point, let's wait until the Minnesota Supreme Court rules, and then we have an idea of what we're going to be faced with, and then work on legislation at that point to conform with what the Minnesota Supreme Court has to say. So I think that's about all I have, unless there's questions. With me, I should introduce Pat Malberg. He's with Fredrickson and Byron. He is our lead counsel for the CAPEX projects regarding land rights issues and knows a lot more law than I do. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Mr. Malberg, do you need to say anything, or are you just here to answer questions?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one editorial comment. First and foremost, is that I thought we made the laws in the legislature, not the judicial branch. I mean, we have separation of powers for a reason. This is where we write the laws, not the court. I guess, Mr. Lesher, here's a question for you. When you propose a route and a route is established and the affected parties in that, when you do an appraisal, is their appraisal more or less than it would have been without the proposed line?
Mr. Lesher.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Falk, good to see you again. When we do an appraisal, we look at the before and after of the taking. So we look at what the property valued before the transmission came, and we look at the property with the transmission line. And that goes into our, and as you can imagine, every property is very unique and very different. So we have to look at each property on a case-by-case basis. Generally, what we do is we set up a payment schedule, if we need to do an appraisal to try and define that even more, that's what we do. But our initial offer, typically we believe is enough to cover any costs of any issues with damages to the remainder of the property. But in some cases, a detailed appraisal is necessary, and that takes into account all the factors that come with the transmission line routing.
Perhaps I should have
Representative Falk.
Rephrased my question. I guess, I mean, your appraisal is probably going to be fairer to your side of the equation or the business transaction than the individual's appraisal. I would just think common sense and logic would dictate that a property with a large transmission line on it would have less value than a same or similar property without a large transmission line. I mean, logic seems to dictate that. And so I'm just trying to square how it is that you feel that by paying the minimum price, that you're not getting an unfair subsidy, because essentially if they're not getting the purchase, that person that's having their property condemned or taken through eminent domain is not getting the true value, and because you're part of the equation is when you run a power line through, potentially a power line through there, it automatically diminishes the value. How is it that you're not getting an unfair subsidy?
Mr. Lesher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I think I understand your question. And first I should say that the appraisers that we use are appraisers that have been on both sides, the landowner's side or the condemning authority side. They're completely at their own judgment as far as what the value of the taking should be. They look at all factors. They look at comps. They look at where other transmission lines have impacted properties and how that has transpired. And so, I mean, it's a completely neutral appraisal as far as they're concerned, and they're going to have to be the ones that testify in the courts when we get to the eminent domain proceedings. And so they have to stand behind their products, and we believe that they do. But, you know, that's really the beauty of the eminent domain process, is that everyone gets a fair shake. If we do an appraisal on a piece of property and we come up with X and the property owner does an appraisal and it's 2X, then we have, the state of Minnesota has done an excellent job of in the eminent domain laws of setting it up that we can take that forward. And Mr. Crass and others can represent landowners and take that forward to an impartial group to make a decision on what the final judgment should be. And so it's not only up to us on what the payment should be. If a landowner agrees with our amount, then that's great and we can avoid litigation. But if we do take it forward to condemnation, then, you know, the laws are in place to protect the landowner, and we you know, fully support that. And so I think that's where I would stand on that issue.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it opened up a whole other set of issues there. I mean, I don't think that the process is fair, but I'm just trying to understand. So if you took two identical pieces of property and one had a transmission line on it, would that one have a lower value? Or you take the same piece of property and then put a line on top of it, would it have a lower value?
Mr. Lesher.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Falk, I don't know the type of property you're referring to. I have
farmland. Pick identical farms. One has a power line, one does not. Would the one with the power line have a lesser value, all other factors being equal and identical?
Mr. Lesher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, we're talking about something that there are many types of agricultural properties that are out there. It would depend on where the structures are.
Let's take one of these dairy farms.
Okay.
One has a power line, one doesn't. Which one has a higher value?
Mr. Lesher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I would say all factors being equal, there may be some detriment in value to that property that has the transmission line. I think what we have historically seen is that negative impact in the value is generally seen within the first few years of the transmission line being there, because you have a piece of property that didn't have a transmission line, now it does. There may be a detriment in value, which we would fully anticipate taking care of in our easement payments or condemnation payments. But as the years go by, I mean, there's plenty of data out there to suggest that as the years go by, that the transmission line being there wouldn't have any impact on the value whatsoever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I imagine we could continue this line of debate here, but I mean, I think it's pretty easy for you when you're not the one that's suffering any detriment in the value. I mean, if it were your home and somebody proposed, you know, running any type of utility across it and your value were to be decreased by a significant amount and your recourse over that was a partial portion of that significant amount, you would probably feel upset as well. And I'm just saying that this right now is an unlevel playing field. And for the value of these lines and the amount of tariffs that will be collected off of them that will be reflected to the utilities, especially the for-profit utilities, this is a very small amount of the total project cost and the total value of these lines to treat people fairly. And I would just ask that you try to treat people fairly, because that's clearly not happening.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lesher, I asked previously if I guess they're called public service corporations. If utilities have to follow the same eminent domain law that public entities such as MnDOT or Ohio County would have to follow, Mr. Crass said that they don't, and couldn't identify a reason why they shouldn't. I would ask you the same two questions.
Mr. Lesher.
Mr. Chair, if Pat would be okay with answering this question, I think this would be appropriate.
Please identify yourself for the tape and answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representatives. My name is Patrick Malbert. I'm Land Rights Counsel for the CapEx project. Representative Winkler, the fact of the matter is that all condemning authorities are treated equal except for high-voltage transmission line condemning authorities. And the difference is there are more rights given to landowners against the high-voltage transmission line projects than other condemning authorities. Take, for example, the property in Wright County. It's 63 acres. The project needs an easement of 7 acres. The landowner, because this is a high-voltage transmission line, has the option and has, in fact, elected to force the utilities to take the entire property. if that same line, if that same easement was necessary for a road, MnDOT would be taking an easement, and the landowner wouldn't have the ability to force the utility to condemn the entire property or force MnDOT to take the entire property. So I don't think that all condemning authorities are being treated equally under the law. In fact, there are special privileges against the utilities.
Representative Whitehead. Mr. Chair, Mr. Mulvaker, as I look at Minnesota Statute 117.189, it creates a number of exemptions to the eminent domain law. And this is on our bill. It's 1.7 to 1.11. Creates a number of exemptions to the eminent domain law that do not apply to public service corporations for any purpose other than construction of these things. So as I read this, in the case of a pipeline or a transmission line of 100 kilovolts or more, then those provisions of 117 do apply. But otherwise, those sections of eminent domain law do not apply to public service corporations. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Mulberg.
Chair Nelson, Representative Winkler, I think that I understand what you're saying, and correct, under 117.189 as currently written, there are certain exemptions if the utility's line is less than 100 kilovolts. But the By the Farm statute is triggered when there's a line that has 200 kilovolts or more, so that exemption is not effective with respect to the CapEx project. With respect to the remainder, for example, line 1.16 through line 1.19, that's the appraisal piece that CapEx is not opposed to making uniform with other condemning authorities.
And Mr. Mulberg, that part was taken out of the bill, so it's not in the bill. That isn't being changed.
Mr. Chair, and you know, I will grant you that these exemptions in 117 are not applicable specifically to the CapEx project and the By the Farm law. But in general, it seems like we have created special circumstances for utilities in condemnation. And my only comment would be, perhaps Representative Bly's bill does not go nearly far enough in treating like entities, or I mean, in treating public and private entities in the same, in subjecting them to the same laws. And I just have real concern with, I'll just say, you know, we have people with going concerns who can make their own judgment about whether or not this is going to limit their ability to continue the operations of their business, and they really have no recourse if we do not enact this.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I had said in my opening comments, that I hope that representatives listen to this very carefully, because this is a very, very big issue in the definition of what damages are. And listening to the example that's been put forward of if MnDOT has a taking for an intersection versus this type of taking and the compensation, I would submit that there is more of a taking if we're talking about a utility line, because you're taking subsurface rights, surface rights, and air rights with this type of a taking, versus the primary taking would be a surface right if you're talking about an intersection or a stretch of road that MnDOT is looking to improve. So I'm not exactly sure if it's apples to apples on this, because we don't have, as some communities in some states do, tiered highways that go up in into the air rights. We have pretty much surface highways here in the state of Minnesota, so I question whether or not that's a completely apples to apples analogy. The second part that really rings hollow for me on this is the idea that if we go out and we compensate people, we're taking an easement versus fee title on this. There are a lot of extenuating circumstances. I think that Representative Falk hit on a few of those. But primarily, I can make and argue a case for the improvement of real estate if there is road infrastructure that's put in there. There's a highway. There are exit ramps that are going to frontage roads, that are going to job-creating entities, where this is clearly for the benefit of all utility customers. But the burden of supporting some of this is being put on the backs of maybe not even customers or a few of the customers. And so the scope of damages really needs to be identified. And I'm not arguing for or against either position on this. I think we need to have good public policy on it. I don't think we're at that point. I'm of an age where I remember the 1970s and the horrible troubles that the utilities had, and after the fact they admitted it cost us more to go this route with litigation, with goodwill, with poor public policy, poor management of the process, had we done it differently. And I'm a little taken aback by the fact that we hadn't learned anything in 40 years. We're still having these same kinds of questions, same kinds of issues. And to erect a 150-foot tower, because I go back and forth in my district every week, and I watch the construction of those towers, I've watched the inspection of those towers, the stringing of the lines on those towers, and there's an aesthetics issue there as well. I'm not arguing that in my, or bringing that forward in my summation here today. I'm just saying that we're dealing with multiple rights that are on here that are when we talk about the ownership of property. So when an owner says, you know what, I've got a situation where I have to drive under these, yeah, you may well be within the right of your easement, but that still limits their ability to use that other property. And I'm wondering if the taking doesn't go further than just a simple $7,000 an acre times 7 acres is $49,000, here's your check. I think it can impact the value of the business. I think it can impact the future value of that property as a going concern. And I would be very concerned as well if I invested a lot of my life into a business, what Representative Pepin says, we're just about buy the farm, and treating all persons fairly, because this does affect my district, and I have had calls from folks on this. And yes, CapEx has gone out and tried to negotiate, but some of the stories that I've heard and some of the conversations I've had, we need to do something on this. What it is exactly, I don't know, but we need to do something. And again, I just want members to take this very seriously.
Representative Pepin, before I go to you, I want to get this voted out of here by our normal time, 11:30, so if we can get to that, we have to be in session at noon.
Representative Pepin. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if this question, maybe Mr. Malmberg was it, or Mr. Lusher. Representative Falk had some interesting questions and comments about treating landowners fairly, and so my question is, and I'm not sure if this you know as much about some other energy policy, but I'm just wondering if wind developers are required to treat nearby property owners fairly when they put up windmills that create a lot of land noise and diminish the property value of nearby landowners. Are you familiar with that? And wondering if they're also required to treat nearby property owners fairly, as Representative Falk mentioned.
Chair Nelson, Representative
Mr. Malmberg.
I'll take this one. In Minnesota, the ability to receive just compensation applies to the landowner whose property is taken. If you are a neighboring property that has no physical taking, there's no easement, there's no fee being taken, you do not have the ability to be compensated for that.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Malmberg, well, I guess I would view that as neighboring property owners are not treated fairly in those cases because they are not compensated for the loss in value to their property through the noise, through, you know, just the many people view it as an eyesore to have one there. And so, I mean, perhaps that's something that should be looked at as well. But just on a different line of questioning, I'm just wondering, this is probably for Mr. Loescher. I'm just wondering, my guess is that you're a business, you know, utilities are businesses, so they're going to try to be as cost efficient as possible. And I'm wondering how difficult it will be to reroute lines and how cost prohibitive it will be to reroute lines to avoid these farms. And I'm assuming that rate will get passed on to the landowner, to the ratepayers. And just wondering if that will kind of be the route you think that utilities will go, just to kind of avoid it and reroute lines, how difficult that is and how much that will cost us.
Mr. Leisure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would say that you know, and this kind of goes back to a comment that was made about have we learned anything from what we did back in the 70s. I would say that we've learned a lot. The process that we've undertaken for the CapEx lines, and not just with the regulatory arms of the PUC. I mean, we have gone through years of public outreach to try and route the lines as best as possible, to impact the fewest number of people, to try and utilize as much as we possibly can the existing rights of way, whether those are interstates, county roads, public roads, putting the lines on property lines, natural boundaries. All of that comes as a direct result of what happened back in the 70s and when things weren't looked at that way. So I think, you know, as far as routing and rerouting around different people, you know, we had years of public input. I can attest to tell you right now that there is no way we can route a transmission line without affecting somebody. Somebody's going to get affected. You cannot, you know, you have to try and level the playing field and treat everyone the same, whether it's a dairy operation or somebody who's growing corn or a residence. So we really tried to look at that, and then as we took that forward to the PUC, who ultimately decides the route, you know, house counts were looked at, wetlands, just any number of different scenarios were looked at to try and minimize the impacts as best we possibly could. So I would say that the routes that are put forward and the routes that we are working with are good routes, and they've got a lot of backing and they've got a lot of documentation to go along with those. I would say if we had to look at new routes, I mean, it would be very costly and delay the project, delay the in-service dates of these projects that are needed for the state of Minnesota. And so, you know, I think the cost would be great. But having said that, you know, there are cases where we have worked with landowners to try and reroute the line if they can work together. And I'm talking about sort of a very localized cluster of landowners. If there's something that might work better, we're certainly open to that. And I myself have worked on a number of those cases, just on the Brookings line alone. And I know of a number on the Fargo projects as well. But, you know, costs are important. I mean, we are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. Great River Energy is a co-op. We have our co-ops out there in the local areas of all of these transmission lines. And those costs are going to affect everyone. I mean, they're going to raise rates, and we have to make sure that we are looking at this responsibly. And so, you know, we have a concern. It's been taken to the Supreme Court level, and we're just waiting to find out what that is.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I just have a follow-up. Do you know what just from taking out the commercially viable language in here, and so, you know, you'll have to now purchase swampland and other things. Do you have an estimate at all as to what the dollar amount? I know it would be hard, but perhaps it's possible to figure out a number with looking at your planning and how much that might cost.
And Mr.
That might Lynch, cost.
If you can answer succinctly, not take 5 minutes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I think succinctly we have not put a dollar figure on it exactly. It is a very, very difficult thing to put a dollar figure on. We have the Brookings project in particular is halfway through acquisition. Landowners have 60 days from the condemnation, being delivered the condemnation documents. And so we just don't know how many people are going to elect by the farm. So putting a dollar figure on is going to be very, very difficult. But it could be in the neighborhood for all the projects of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Thank you.
Representative Falk will be the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more to respond to Representative Pepin, being that she did mention me. And there's a couple of clear things that probably should clear up, or things need to be cleared up with respect to different types of independent power producers that are not public utilities. They don't have the power of eminent domain. And when it comes to siting wind turbines, for instance, in the state, we have local ordinances in many counties, and typically you have to be at least 1.1 times the maximum tip height back from a property line. In many cases, that's more than 500 feet. many counties, too, they have requirements that you're at least 750 feet, 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet back from a residence, from a turbine. And so, I mean, if you want to start debating the, you know, the similarities between this, I'm, you know, happy to do that. But I do think that you're, you know, looking at a very dissimilar types of projects. And we have local zoning in place in many instances, or we have the zoning of the PUC, which allows people to go and have their voices heard. They don't have the same powers as a public utility has with respect to eminent domain. And I haven't seen a single project, renewable project like that, that's tried to take somebody's property. And we can have another debate, too, about whether or not these projects are needed. There's other alternatives to how we can meet our energy needs without establishing new corridors. And to a final point about the cost, too. Now, I will give the co-ops and the munis, you know, the fact that they're not-for-profits, but for the investor-owned utilities, this gets put into the asset base, and they're allowed to earn a rate of return on it each and every year. And so the more things you can put in your asset base improves your profitability. And so there's a justification to try to get as much stuff there that you can possibly get allowed by the PUC, because that more assets mean a larger allowable base you can earn upon. And so I wouldn't always say these things are just and prudent, but it's what they can get by the PUC, which would allow them to earn on their asset base.
Representative Pepin, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Falk. Well, I didn't start this. I just was commenting that you had pointed out that the utility industry was treating folks unfairly, and I was just pointing out that there are many views of that. Some people, I think there was a congressman that lived out by Martha's Vineyard who was very keen on wind energy, except for when it was actually in his backyard. I think that's called NIMBY. And so I think that there's a lot of ways that people can view whether or not someone's treated fairly. And so I just thought I'd point out that some people would not be very happy being, whether or not there's eminent domain involved, living next to a wind farm. So I just wanted to point that out, and we can have debates all day long. I just thought it was a fair argument to discuss, because you seem to think that the utility industry is unfair, and I thought that was an unjust accusation.
Representative Bly, wrap up.
I'm not sure that there's more that I would want to say. I think that you have before you the arguments, and we can take the vote.
So I'll renew my motion that House File 338 be passed and re-referred to Rules. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The motion's approved. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
And members, before we adjourn, we have a couple bills, one of them being pensions bill that's going to come to us that we need to hear on Friday, and hopefully there's a couple other ones I've been hearing rumors about. We'll hopefully get them done as quickly as possible. We're meeting in room 5 at 8:15 on Friday morning. With that, members, we're adjourned.